This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Hi, I'm DW from Houston.
Hi, I'm Kristen from San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Graham from Vancouver, Canada.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did. It's easy.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate. Yes!
I'm Jesse Thorne. Nile Rodgers was there for the very start of disco. His songs can be big, almost over the top. Chic's Le Freak, Diana Ross's I'm Coming Out. That was kind of the point. But when Rodgers is crafting a song, he also pays attention to the little things. Take one of his first hits with Chic, Everybody Dance.
Everybody dance, do-do-do-do, clap your hands.
And I remember I played that for Bernard Edwards the first time, and it was all complicated with these hip jazz chord changes. And he said to me, my man, it's happening, but what does do-do-do-do mean? And I said, well, you know, it's the same thing as la-la-la-la. He said, well, why don't you say that? And I said, because do-do-do-do is hipper. I said, if you listen to all these, like, these records, you always hear him go, do-do-do-do-do-do, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. No one's going, la-la-la-la-la-la. It was like the difference between hip and being, you know, like a Boy Scout around a campfire. It was just changed.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I talk with the producer and musician Nile Rodgers. Sometimes it seems like everything he touches turns platinum. Nile Rodgers produced hits for Diana Ross, Madonna, David Bowie, and a whole pile of others. We'll talk about the musical movement he was at the very front of, disco, and why it dominated.
You know, if you look at the time period, you have this all-inclusive music, this all-inclusive scene. Didn't make any difference whether you're white, black, fat, gay. If you had music that kept people on the dance floor, you rule.
And he'll reflect on the first time he saw the glam rock group Roxy Music.
It was almost spiritual, I have to say.
Plus, we'll hear a classic bit from the powerhouse comedy duo of the 50s and 60s, Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And I'll tell you about the rare fashion journalist who cares as much about 16-year-olds in Harlem as he does about models smoking outside shows, Bill Cunningham. All that coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. Every week on Bullseye, we're joined by our favorite culture critics to recommend stuff that's worth your time. This week, a couple of all-time faves from Mark Frauenfelder of BoingBoing.net. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Jesse. How's it going?
It's going okay. Let's start with this novel, The Hunter, by Richard Stark, which is actually the name of a man named Donald Westlake. This is a 50-ish-year-old crime novel. What, in your mind, makes it stand the test of time?
Yeah, it's from 1962, and the thing about it is that it really matches the kind of current zeitgeist for dark television shows, where the protagonist is basically a sociopathic, amoral person. But he has to deal with people who are even worse than him. And the writing is really tight, and the plots are good and intriguing. And so I really enjoyed this novel and flipped through it. There were a couple of points in it, actually, where I was so, like, kind of grossed out by what a nasty guy Parker was that I wanted to put it down, but I had to find out what would happen. So I finished it. And I am going to continue to read these novels. I'm really glad that I discovered them.
Let's talk about Every Noise at Once, which is, it's a website. And I'm looking at the website now. It is essentially a word map, if people know what those are. Some words a little bigger than others, spread out across the page, of music genres. And they range from music genres that I certainly recognize, like, say, synth pop or funk rock, to things that I am less familiar with, like Madchester or death grind.
Yeah, it's kind of shaped like a cloud. And so what you do is you just mouse over any one of these genres. I'm guessing there are a couple hundred on the page, maybe 100, between 100 and 200. It's hard to tell. And then you just click on it, and you will hear a sample of that genre. And if you want to explore it further, you click on the little set of arrows next to the genre, and it will take you to another subcloud that has a bunch of bands that fit that genre. And the proximity of the names of the bands to each other, I assume, means that the bands kind of sound alike a little bit. And so this is like such a cool way to find out about bands that and music I've never even heard of before.
Let's give it a try. I've got the website open here, and I'm going to click on Gothic Symphonic Metal. It's all around us too, electrifying you. So glad to set it free. This fatuous thing. Now all I have to do, Mark, is decide which of these is my favorite Gothic Symphonic Metal band. Within Temptation, Forever Slave, Lullacry, Theater of Tragedy, Xandria with an X.
I wonder, is Kate Bush in that list? That sounded slightly... one that I found, Vaporwave, which I had not heard of before, I thought was pretty good.
I think you could have a good time on this website without even listening to the music samples. I mean, you just click on any one of these genres and you get to learn all about Skeleton Lipstick or Dracula Lewis or L.A. Vampires Goes Ital or Pocahontas.
Yeah. Isn't it a fun way to like discover and explore music?
It is. This is fascinating. Well, Mark Frauenfelder from BoingBoing.net recommends Every Noise at Once, the online music map. You'll find the link on our website or just Google Every Noise at Once. And the novel The Hunter by Richard Stark. Thanks as always, Mark.
Thanks a lot, Jesse.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you haven't heard of Nile Rodgers, you've certainly heard his music. He's one of pop's most legendary songwriters and producers. He's worked with groups and artists including but not limited to Duran Duran, Madonna, Mick Jagger, David Bowie, and Diana Ross. And he's also a performer. His own band, Chic, recorded monster, epic, over-the-top hits like Le Freak. The disco pioneer is responsible for the distinctive guitar line on the new Daft Punk single, Get Lucky. Let's hear a little bit of that now. Rodgers and I spoke in 2011 when he had just put out a memoir, Le Freak, an upside-down story of family, disco, and destiny. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be had.
I I was reading, so in the first couple of chapters of your new book, which is called Le Freak, it was sort of a continuing series of revelations of just outrageous family situations.
Yeah.
So let's start. You were born in the very beginning of the 1950s in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about your mother, your father, and the man who had the most fatherish role in your life, your stepfather.
Yes. My mom was a really cool girl. She was actually born in Jersey, but by the time I was born, she had moved to New York City. My biological father is Nile Rodgers Sr. He was a percussionist who was sort of popular at the time. He played with a guy named Paul Whiteman, who was known as the King of Jazz.
And tell me about your stepfather, Bobby.
My stepfather My mom married Bobby, I think, like in the early 60s, maybe even the late 50s. And Bobby was Jewish, incredibly handsome, maybe one of the coolest guys I've ever known.
If you called your mother and stepfather by their first names, and if you had told me that and you were born in, you know, I was born in 1981 or even 1966 and you were 7 years old in 1973 or something like that, I don't think that would be that surprising. But I imagine that in the late 1950s, early 1960s, a black lady and a Jewish guy, married and living together with a few different kids by different people, calling them by their first names in a semi-open marriage, was pretty crazy.
I would say it was a very open marriage. Wasn't anything semi about it.
Were you aware of the way that you were culturally different from your peers? That you had these hipster and later to a growing extent junkie parents, and they were, you know, they had their artsy friends over. All I can imagine, you don't describe it too specifically, but I just imagine a lot of people in black turtlenecks snapping instead of clapping.
Absolutely. It was almost a caricature of the beatnik scene. I remember when this television show called Dobie Gillis came on and they had this character, Maynard G. Krebs. I was like, that's my man. I know Maynard. You know, it didn't seem weird to me. Actually, other people's families seemed weird because everybody in my immediate circle they were like my parents. So everybody talked that hipster talk. Everybody was like, hey, you know, the super slow junkie thing. Hey, Nile, what's that? No one ever called me Nile. I was Pud. But, you know, hey, Pud, what's happening? Did you see Strangers on a Train? Yeah, that Hitchcock is a you know, it was all that kind of, it was all that kind of stuff. And I was a kid, so it was normal. It was completely normal. And the amount of gay people, the amount of, I mean, it was a colorful crowd.
The other thing about your childhood, as you describe it in your book, is that you were in 1,000 different places and also nowhere. I mean, you were living with your two grandmothers. You had, you know, it just feels like I don't hear from you telling your story any time where you could be like, this is the place where I am me and not where I have to have my dukes up.
Well, that's almost true. When the hippie movement became really popular, that was the first time I felt really, really comfortable. From a very early age, I developed insomnia really young, and I'd stay up all night, much to the discomfort of the adults in my world, because I'd have the light on or the television on or something like that, and they'd get off. So I started to run away and sleep on the train and then sneak back in the house before they'd wake up in the morning. So one day when I was a lot older, I was about 15 or 16, I had just moved back to New York from Los Angeles, and I snuck out to sleep on the subway, and I ran into a hippie, and this guy sort of took me under his wing, and from that moment on, I never really slept at home again, at least not for any lengthy period of time. But that night that I met this guy, we went and we slept in a crash pad, and it was a room filled with bodies, everybody lying on the floor on mattresses and wall-to-wall mattresses, and we smoked from a big hookah. And it was that communal life that made me feel comfortable because I always felt like someone had my back.
The last time I visited my aunt in Washington, D.C., who's probably just about your age, she told me about going to Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
And she's African-American, and she was just in her closet, and she pulled out this huge peace sign that she had in the back of her car. And she's like, oh, I put this in the back of my car for when I drove to Woodstock. And her memory of Woodstock
was... That means
was,
she's a little older than me. She had a driver's license.
Okay, fair enough. So she and but not much because she's the kind of lady who was doing that stuff at 16. So she she said to me, her recollection of Woodstock was this, that she got there, she looked around and saw all the white people and thought, oh, I'm the only person here to see Sly.
Right.
And I wonder if you had any self-consciousness about race being in a hippie world that was very, you know, it was partly about eliminating race as a category, but it was also very racialized.
Yeah, it was very real. I was lucky because I lived in a certain part of New York. I lived in Greenwich Village. And even when I moved to the Bronx, all of my friends were sort of, they were black hippies, they were white hippies, Puerto Ricans. We were from this really eclectic, unusual mix of people. My best friends were deadheads. All the deadheads I knew were black. Some of the musicians that I played with Leopold Stokowski's sons, the genius head of the American Symphony Orchestra. So we were a very cool group. It wasn't the racism that we used to feel mainly came from the outside world. In the hippie culture, I came along during the time of the White Panthers, John Sinclair, the MC5, David Peel and the Lower East Side, the Stooges. So I come from a background where a lot of the musicians, whatever racism and racial problems that you had in society, that would go away in the context of a band.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the musician and record producer Nile Rodgers. In 1970, Nile Rodgers met bassist Bernard Edwards and formed the Big Apple Band. They backed the R&B group New York City on the hit I'm Doing Fine Now. Let's hear a little bit of it. You were playing with a sort of traditional R&B group touring the country, and that group who had had a big hit and had opened for the Jackson 5 didn't end up having a lot of other chart success, and you were playing with other groups on and off, and this sort of ran from the early 70s into the mid-70s when disco started to happen for real. I wonder if you could describe to me just aesthetically what the difference was between the disco records that started to percolate in the mid-70s and the R&B records of just a couple of years earlier.
Basically what had happened, there was a sort of political, spiritual, and musical convergence of all of these disparate, seemingly unconnected vibes. And what happened was disco was the sort of party that said, come on in, everybody's invited, you know, the water's fine. And I noticed that the jazz guys that I used to follow religiously were all of a sudden starting to get hit records that were on the same charts as the R&B artists. And then every now and then they would cross over to the pop and rock artists. And it wasn't really called disco at the time. It would later be called disco, but it at the beginning it was just sort of R&B. It was groove, it was funk, it was dance music, it was some other thing, but it had this shared DNA of jazz and R&B, but it was very open. And when I heard that happening and I saw it on the charts, the time had finally come where I knew where I belonged, where I had a place that I could do my jazzy, classical, wacky stuff and also write commercial hooks. And the very first song I composed for that style was a song by my band Chic called Everybody Dance. And with these really hip chord changes, but I superimposed this a ridiculously simple melody. And I wrote,
everybody dance, do-do-do-do, clap your hands, clap your hands.
And I remember I played that for Bernard Edwards the first time, and it was all complicated with these hip jazz chord changes. And he said to me, my man, you know, it's happening, but what the f*** does doo-doo-doo-doo mean? And I said, well, you know, it's the same thing as la-la-la-la. He said, well, why don't you say that? And I said, because doo-doo-doo-doo is hipper. I said, if you listen to all these, like, these records, you always hear him go, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. No one's going, la-la-la-la-la-la. It was like the difference between hip and being, you know, like a Boy Scout around a campfire. So I stuck that in Everybody Dance, and Chic was off and running. I was listening to that song. I hadn't listened to it in a while. And the thing that struck me was just the absurd complexity of the bass line of that song.
It's ridiculous.
Because, I mean, it is like a lot of dance records from that period. The bass is a really important part of the melody of that song. But it is just going all over everywhere. I mean, it is. There's a thousand different things happening.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting to me that one of the things that typified those Chic records was the confluence of the simplest of simple, that they were driven by the classic disco beat, I mean, with a lot of other stuff going on around it on the drums as well. But mm-hmm. the central thing is that classic disco beat. They're driven by lyrics like, I mean, they're all called Dance Something.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, every song's
Everybody
lyrics
dance,
is like,
dance,
we're all
dance,
dancing
dance.
Together. I'm enjoying dancing. Like, hey, isn't dancing great? But then there are also these other things that are going on that are, like, laughably complicated for a pop record.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's what we call, in Chic, that's what we used to call DHM, the deep hidden meaning. I as a writer, and the most complicated person in the world, maybe even as a person, I'm ridiculous. And that's because everything that I do is governed by these invisible voices in my head of my old music teachers, what I call the jazz and classical police. Excuse me now, during the recapitulation, it's like, okay, will the counterpoint come? Like, okay, guys. So that's the voices I always hear. Every time I write a song, it's so complicated, it's ridiculous. And Bernard used to be the great divining rod to find the water that would save our lives, because I was like, you know, this stuff is too complicated. And many times he would say to me, brother, you got 5 or 6 songs in here. And he was right. We'd wind up writing 5 or 6 songs from an original idea that I would have.
You also helped create another central distinguishing element of disco as a sound, which is that breakdowns and breaks,
right?
Which, you know, I mean, obviously your song Good Times was transformed into the first huge hip hop record, were a central part of what you were doing, which was something that you could do. Because you could make a lot, you could put a lot more music on a 12-inch record than you could on a 45.
Correct.
And so you had room to have something very complicated, break it all the way down to the simplest, sometimes even just a drum pattern.
That's right.
And then build it back up.
The concept with Chic was we believed our parts were clever. We were a part-playing band. And we always wanted to show it off. You know what I mean? So our basic philosophy was, you know, a song is just an excuse to go to a chorus, and a chorus is just an excuse to go to the breakdown. And that's really what we believed in. We just couldn't wait to get to the breakdown. And that was our thing. We wanted to show people how the song was constructed, and basically what we would do is we take it apart and then we rebuild it in the listener's ears, so you could hear all those little parts come in. Because typically when you hear the full groove, you actually don't really know what we're playing. When I hear cover bands play Chic songs, I'm laughing. I go, that's what you think we're playing? They don't get the subtleties. They don't understand the upbeats going against the down and still sounding like it's all in the pocket because we have the four in the floor bass drum. So we were always proud of what we did, and we wanted to show people how hip it was. And we also knew that breakdowns worked live.
After a break, Nile Rodgers will talk about producing for Diana Ross, David Bowie, and the first time that he saw Roxy Music.
It was almost spiritual, I have to say.
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hi, this is Biz.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host a new show about the epic fails and genius moments of being a mom.
How do you take care of a baby and still find time to moisturize your tattoos? Join us every week to find out.
And remember, you don't have to be a bad mom to be one bad mother.
Subscribe for free on iTunes or go to MaximumFun.org.
Hey, gang. You can subscribe to the Bullseye Podcast at MaximumFun.org.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the musician and record producer Nile Rodgers. We spoke in 2011. When we left off, we were talking about his days ruling the world of disco in the band Chic. Things were changing in pop music as the idea of a dance club where DJs played records became central to people's experience of pop music relative to, say, hearing a song on the radio or going to see a band. And part of what that allowed was something that I think was central to what Chic was, which is it allowed for a band to exist as much as a concept or a sort of set of aesthetic values, you know, visual and musical and the whole nine yards, as a group of people. So Chic were largely invisible. I mean, your shows were essentially an effort to create a live version of the album covers that didn't feature any of you.
Right.
That's a really interesting idea to me, that you could start a band that almost removes the people from the equation.
Right. You're really, I love talking to you. You're great, man. This is, I'm not going to get any sleep today. You got it spot on. What happened was the etiology of that concept was, I went to a show in London to see Roxy Music, and the Roxy Music was playing at this joint called the Roxy Theater or the Roxy Hall or something. And when I got in there, I had never heard of Roxy Music prior to this. The girl I was dating took me there to see these guys. And when I got inside, I had seen something that was sort of familiar, like what I had seen at the Apollo, you know, because everybody came in with their shtick and their costumes and the whole bit. But once they got off stage, then somebody else came on. But Roxy Music, they presented what I started to call a total immersive artistic experience. Like when you walked inside, it was amazing. The audience seemed like part of the vibe. This sort of this textural music, it was almost spiritual, I have to say. And then when we put our Chic Sophisto funk band together, because we sort of designed it, we had an outline, we had a thumbnail concept of what it would be, and we started to fit the pieces into the puzzle. I describe it was sort of like the Magnificent Seven. You go out and you're looking for gunslingers, and we found Tony Thompson first, who had just come from LaBelle, so he was into the fantasy fusion thing, so that was cool. Then we found Rob Sabino, and Rob Sabino is the real sort of undersung hero in Chic, because Rob Sabino turned us on to his buddy Ace Frehley's band, which was Kiss. And when we went to see Kiss, pow, all of a sudden it was clear as a bell. These guys were on stage. It was almost like a carnival where they come to town, you get immersed in the world of Kiss, and they pack up and go to the next town. And I just looked at Bernard and said, this is it. We have to do this. And Bernard agreed, because Bernard knew that I didn't look like him or I didn't act like him. And he certainly didn't look like me or act like me, but we could create this thing where we both could come together and be those guys. We were role playing. And we could both put on suits. We could pretend that we were Cab Calloway or something like that. But the modern version of Cab Calloway, a modern version of Count Basie. You know, Count Basie was the band leader. He sat there on the piano, but it was all the soloists and all those guys in his band that were the stars. He was the arranger. That's what Nile Rodgers was. Nile Rodgers was the songwriter, arranger. Bernard Edwards was the guy who was the band leader. And that's how our partnership worked so great. And at that point, you know, if you look at the time period, you have this all-inclusive music, this all-inclusive scene. Didn't make any difference whether you're white, black, fat, gay, lesbian, whatever. If you had music that kept people on the dance floor, you ruled. We never had to explain it to the musicians. Like, we never had to tell you know, other musicians what Chic was about and what our concept was about. And they never really called us a disco band in the same way that you would call Cerrone disco. Cerrone is clearly disco. The Village People are clearly disco. We were this other funk dance thing, which now I will call disco because everybody keeps doing it, so forget it. You can't beat them, join them. One guy told me that our music was what they called black disco. I went, oh, guys, come on already.
I want to ask you about that part of it, because disco at its height in, you know, 1978, 1979, was getting it from two sides. One side was this return to rock and roll that spawned Disco Sucks, the Disco mm-hmm. Sucks movie.
Right.
That was, I think we can say now, 30 years later, informed, you know, partly by people's aesthetic preferences, but also partly by a combination of racism and homophobia.
Yeah.
People who did not like the idea of a world where everybody came in together.
That's
in that
right.
way that you
and
described.
And that Sylvester could outsell the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, but the other way that disco was getting it was from people who saw themselves as defenders of blackness,
mm-hmm.
Who did not like the way disco essentially deracinated, took the race out mm-hmm. of dance music. So, you know, like Funkadelic had a character named the Anti-Disco Kid.
Right.
And so there are these two forces pushing against disco. And I wonder, I mean, I think that we hear a lot about the one where, you know, meathead rock and rollers are burning disco
right.
records. But as a guy who thought of himself partly as being in a funk band, how did you feel about that pressure coming from the other side, that you had come from this musical movement in 1973 where, you know, blackness was central
right.
to black popular music in 1970.
Right.
Could not have been more, you know,
right.
I'm black and I'm proud.
That's right.
But then 5 years later, part of what disco was about was eliminating race from the conversation.
Right, but you're absolutely right. So there's two great examples for me. At the same time there was Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, Curtis Mayfield wrote, If There's a Hell Below, We're All Gonna Go. And it was from this, it's the same era. We did a show in San Diego 1 year where we were opening for Marvin Gaye, and Marvin had never heard of us really. And, anyway, we played, we got a huge standing ovation. Years later, when I thought that Marvin Gaye hated us because the San Diego show was unbelievable. If you look at any of the Chic tour books and they ask the members of Chic, what's the most memorable show? It's San Diego, California. So years later, somebody asked Marvin Gaye how he felt about disco and did he like any disco music? And he says, well, you know, there is one band I like. One band, Marvin Gaye. And I'm like going, what band is that? And he says, Chic. And he says, yeah, Chic. They really do some interesting stuff with. I mean, you can find the interview. It's on record. I couldn't believe it. I just found this out when I was doing this book. And I thought, wow. You know, because Marvin Gaye would have been in the other side that was anti the four and the floor, the anti, not as an artist, he wouldn't be anti Sylvester. I mean, believe me, anybody like Marvin, anybody like Sylvester, you had to have respect for him. Because, you know, the artists that were those
the early sort of disco pioneers that were obviously gay and blah, blah, blah. I mean, have you ever listened to the Village People's first album? I think it's sheer genius. And I also think that it's that kind of record that was so brilliant and so popular that it does put people on edge. They don't want to believe that gay people can come up with something that's that incredible, that that so holistically defines where they're coming from and do it in such an artistic way that the deep hidden meaning of that project almost becomes irrelevant. Like, you know, when you think about the New York Yankees adopting YMCA, and they have umpires who are basically guys who go D's, them, and those on the field going, YMCA.
I mean, one of the things that's, I think, so powerful about it is that it is something, those most powerful moments in disco are, a lot of them are super, super gay. Culturally,
right.
Come from
right. Yeah.
Just super gayness.
Yeah.
And they are uniting people who, especially in 1979, but even today, are very uncomfortable.
That's right.
With that word.
I mean, when you think about it, when we wrote We Are Family for Sister Sledge, we honestly were just writing an R&B breakdown dance record for a group of sisters that we had never met, but we saw these girls as a cutting edge family like the Jackson Five. So it was sincere. We were trying to define these girls that were on the cutting edge, defining that lifestyle. And of course, we know that when it comes to fashion, there are a lot of gay voices in fashion. When it comes to that sort of cutting edge visual arts coming together, there's a gay undercurrent, if not a frontal gay thing. And my favorite thing in life was to watch the Pittsburgh Pirates sing I Got All My Sisters With Me. Bernard and I used to laugh our asses off. It was hysterical. We used to say, look at these big, burly men who are probably some of the most macho dudes in America, especially
Willie
in those
Stargell,
days.
Right? Like
right.
6'5", 250.
Right, yeah, like 1,000,000 pounds. Looks like a sumo wrestler. And they're all going, we are family. I got all my sisters with me. And Nard and I used to crack up because if you went to a gay club and played that, you'd see people who were flamboyant singing the same song with the same zeal. And that's what we really believed in. And that's what the disco movement gave everybody.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Nile Rodgers. The disco legend appears on the new Daft Punk album, Random Access Memories. He and I spoke in 2011 when he had just put out his memoir, Le Freak, an upside-down story of family, disco, and destiny.
You wrote and produced one of the all-time great gay anthems.
I'm coming out. Okay,
which is I'm coming out. Let's take a little bit of a listen to Diana Ross and I'm Coming Out. So first of all, tell me whether Diana Ross, at the peak of her divaness, at the apex of her celebrity and just control of the world, A, knew and understood that this was basically a gay song, and B, if she did, what did she think about that idea? And where did this even come from that you were going to write this record for?
All right, so here's the deal with that. All of the coolest clubs in New York
catered to a crowd that went to go there to socialize and hide from the mainstream or go to a place where they could be accepted as a mainstream. So there was a transvestite club called the Gilded Grape. Now, when I say transvestite club, that's not fair because anybody could go to the Gilded Grape. And matter of fact, everybody went to the Gilded Grape. It was happening. I went there to pick up girls. It was a happening spot.
But there were a not insignificant number of transvestites.
Yes, there was a fair amount. The club. Absolutely.
You might even say they were the club's raison d'être.
Yeah, that's exactly. And they actually called those places tranny clubs or transvestite clubs. Or there was a million names, but basically that's who was there. So I happened to be in the bathroom on one of the rare occasions that I used the bathroom for actually, you know, going to the toilet. And I happened to notice that on either side of me, I was flanked by a minimum of two Diana Ross lookalikes. And I really believe that it was three or more, but I will say, you know, conservatively, it was just two. But it was still enough for me to get that light bulb over my head and go, oh, my God. What if Diana Ross, because we were working on her record at the time, I was like, what if Diana Ross was either gay or she at least acknowledged, you know, the gay movement and how much they idolize her. And she's like an important part. That's an important part of her fan base. So I called Bernard and I says, what if we did a song called I'm Coming Out? And he looked at me and he says, damn, that's a great idea. So we wrote it and did the whole thing, orchestrated it. Now, my technique is I never let the artists hear the records until it's time for them to perform because I want to get that spark. I want them to perform for me just as I perform for them when I'm making a record. I never want a demo. Don't send me any demos. I'll play it on the spot. So Diana didn't appreciate it, but, you know, she came in and the first couple of songs that we had written made her really happy. So then we played I'm Coming Out. And she loved it. She sang it. She was into it. It was great. Anyway, she went and she had a meeting with the number one DJ in America, who at the time was named Frankie Crocker. And when she came back in the studio, her mood had changed considerably. And she was really upset. And she just said to us point blank, why are we trying to ruin her career? And we said, Diana, what are you talking about? Well, you know, Frankie told me that this is a gay song and people are going to think I'm gay because I'm saying I'm coming out. And this is the one and only time in my career I have ever lied to an artist. But I looked Diana Ross straight in the eye and went, what are you talking about?
Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hi, I'm homosensual Brian Stoffe.
And I'm feminasty Erin Gibson, and we host
Throwing Shade,
where we take a weekly look at all the issues important to ladies
and gays
and treat them with much less respect than they deserve.
It's for gay people. It's for straight people. It's for ladies.
It's for people who love to laugh, who love comedy, and love tragedy and love crying.
And who hate drinking and driving because that's messed up.
And don't text.
Check out Throwing Shade.
Subscribe for free in iTunes or go to MaximumFun.org.
Bullseye's on Twitter. Follow us online at twitter.com/bullseye.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Nile Rodgers. The disco legend appears on the new Daft Punk album, Random Access Memories. He and I spoke in 2011 when he had just put out his memoir, Le Freak, an upside-down story of family, disco, and destiny. In 1983, you produced David Bowie's best-selling record, and it had this amazing single on it called Let's Dance, and I want to hear a little bit of this.
If you say run,
there's something really interesting to me about this song, because it came for you after disco had gone from everything to nothing in the space of, I don't know, 2 years maybe. And your power as ultimate hitmaker with your partner Bernard Edwards had gone from, you know, just solid platinum, everything you touched, to not working anymore because people hate disco. And there's something really amazing about this song, which is that I think that there is a really interesting contrast that a lot of that became pop music, that became what you produced for Madonna and so on and so forth, that was more than just a white person doing black people music, I think. There's this element in this David Bowie song of the coolness of Bowie, the reserve, the rock star, a slightly off-center angularity of Bowie as a contrast with, you know, like a, what sounds in some ways like a what sounds in some ways like a dance record, in some ways like, you know, like it's Twist and Shout or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that is, that was a new thing. And I see somewhere in here you mentioned Bowie describing it as like a postmodern reconstruction of dance music. Yeah. That is what it sounds like because of that. I mean, not dissonance. It's a combination of dissonance and consonance, of that coolness, that pulling back and that pushing forward that comes from dance music.
The interesting thing about the Let's Dance project was when David and I started working on that project, before one note of music was determined to be on that record, all we did was research. And when David was studying himself, I was studying David. He was showing me what the past was, because we could only show the past, right? That's what we, everything that we could listen to and watch was something that was documented. And we were taking these documents to use as the blueprint to go into the future, to this new place. And it was really interesting how the first night David and I met, all we did was talk about jazz, from the most avant-garde to almost the most straight-ahead and commercial. David even instructed me to make hits. I mean, literally, he said, "Nod, I want you to do what you do best." And I was offended. I said, "What do you mean? You know, I was an artist. You don't know what I do best. The world doesn't know what I do best. I've never been unleashed on the world with my genius." I was like, "No, you make hits." "Oh, really?" "Yeah, but I've never made a record that's been a pop record that's that avant-garde, with that little pocket trumpet solo at the beginning. I mean, come on." But only Bowie and guys like that can get away with it. You know, Bowie said to me something really fantastic when we were doing Let's Dance. He says that he's never been placed in a box. He's never felt that to make music, he has to do what people expect him to do, or even what people think he should do. He says he always does whatever it is that makes him feel good, basically. I'm paraphrasing him poorly, but that's what he was saying. And that gave me a lot of strength when we did Let's Dance, because it made me believe that, wow, I could work with this guy who I call the Picasso of rock and roll and make pop songs, but they'd be uniquely his. Nothing sounds like Let's Dance in my repertoire. It's the only thing that sounds like that, and that's because it was for Bowie. Nothing sounds like I'm Coming Out because it was for Diana Ross. Nothing sounds like We Are Family because it was for Sister Sledge.
I want to ask you one last thing, which is that you, about a year ago, you had major cancer surgery.
Yes.
And you had by then already spent years looking at your life in mm-hmm. order to write this book, interviewing family members and all the people that you knew and that kind of thing, as well as just spending time with your recollections. And you had this life that at times, you know, at the height of your addictions was just insanely wild and flirted with death every day, but you never yourself had run into that wall. But I wonder how having that experience of mortality changed both how you looked at your life in the past mm-hmm. and how you looked at how you wanted to use the life that you have in the future.
Well, that's like the greatest question. the life that I want in the future, actually, I wrote about it today on the airplane flying in to Los Angeles, that, and I say this with 100% sincerity, that the life that I want for myself now is however the Grim Reaper, whenever the Grim Reaper decides to claim me and keep me for good, I just want to be able to play songs when I'm doing it. If I lose the ability to play music, I'll probably be, I don't mean to be so fatalistic and end the interview on such a wacky note, but I'm really as good as dead then. I live for music. It's probably unfortunate that I'm so, that myopic, but I don't really mean that. I have a lot of interest, but I could live without those other interests. I cannot live without music. I can't live without being able to play music. Now, what does that mean? I don't have to be a star. I don't have to make hit records anymore. I just have to be able to pick up the guitar and practice.
Musician and record producer Nile Rodgers. We spoke in 2011. His memoir is called Le Freak, an upside-down story of family, disco, and destiny. He also appears on the new Daft Punk album Random Access Memories, including its lead single, Get Lucky. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Mike Nichols and Elaine May were a powerhouse comedy duo whose albums reached the Billboard Top 40 in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Here's a selection from Nichols and May's 1962 classic, Nichols and May Examine Doctors. Office romances can get, you know, complicated. So when the couple works at a hospital, it can become a matter of life and death.
Scalpel.
Scalpel.
Gauze.
Gauze.
More gauze.
More gauze.
More gauze.
More gauze.
More gauze.
More gauze.
A little more gauze.
We don't have any more gauze.
That's all the gauze?
Yeah. I don't know what happened. We had a small roll of gauze.
Give me a sponge.
Sponge.
Clamp.
You have the clamp.
Suture.
We have the suture.
Edith.
Yes?
I love you.
Please, please.
Sponge.
You have the sponge.
Give me another sponge. I want
you
two
have
sponges.
All the sponges.
I have two sponges.
We don't. We only had two sponges.
This is terrible when we wrangle this way.
But
why do you avoid me?
We have two sponges.
Why do you avoid me in the hall?
I don't avoid you in the hall.
You turned your back at the coffee machine.
I didn't turn my
back. You deliberately turned your back.
Excuse me, the oxygen is failing.
Edith, don't change the subject.
But it's failing.
Well, turn it up.
Well, I'm trying to.
Is there somebody else?
Is there something you'd like? A suture? Sponge? Something?
Is there somebody else?
I don't care to discuss it now.
It's Pinsky, isn't it?
I don't care to talk about it.
I saw you in the cafeteria.
I just don't care to talk about it, Dr. Harris. Now, would you like anything else? Otherwise, I'd like to go.
Go in the middle of an operation?
Well, I have nothing else to hand you. You've got it all in the patient.
Edith, what have I done to hurt you this way?
You haven't done anything to hurt me. I just wish you wouldn't badger me.
Badger you?
I need time to think. I told you that before.
I don't know you like this. You're cold. You're diffident.
Because you badger me.
I haven't badgered
You're
you.
You're only making me run away.
Is it badgering you to tell you I love you? Is that badgering you?
Please do not tell me over and over in the cafeteria and in operations.
All right, I'm sorry. Give me a needle.
Needle.
Thread.
Would you like me to thread the needle?
I don't even know what I'm doing. Yes, thread it, please.
All right. Catgut?
Yes.
Cheer up. Come on, I have a little joke for you. Knock, knock.
Oh.
Come on. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Catgut.
Catgut who?
Catgut your tongue? Oh, come on.
Edith, why are you torturing me?
I'm not. I was trying to cheer you up.
Well, there's only one way you can cheer me up, and that's to say yes.
Please, please, Dr. Harris, not now. This is how you drive me away every time.
Put your finger on this knot, please.
All right, but don't do anything funny.
I'm not doing anything funny. I'm sewing up the patient. All now right. It's you who starts these things.
All right, all right.
Oh, I do love you so.
Oh, please, please, let go of my finger. I knew you were going to do this.
Please, no, don't pull back. I love you.
Let go of my finger.
Don't pull back. You're pulling the stick.
Please, Dr. Harris, stop.
Edith, it is Pinsky, isn't it?
I don't want to talk about it now.
It's very important to me to know whether it's Pinsky or not.
Give me time to check. Now the oxygen is failing again.
Let it fail. I'm sick of this torture.
Please, so, Dr. Harris, everyone is looking at you.
I'm not going to finish this operation unless you say yes.
Dr. Harris, you're being impossible.
I'm not going to finish this operation unless you say yes, Edith.
Dr. Harris, this patient will die.
I've been tortured long enough. Yes or no, which is it going to be?
This is absolute blackmail.
I don't care. I don't care what lengths I go to anymore. All is fair and all that.
Dr. Harris, you're a doctor. A doctor. Doesn't that mean anything to you,
yes,
a surgeon?
I'm a doctor, Edith, but I'm a man also, and I will not go on with this operation until you give me your answer, and it better be yes.
I have no choice. Yes.
All right, then. Clamp, darling.
That was from the recently reissued Nichols and May 1962 classic, Nichols and May Examine Doctors. It's available now on CD and digital download. Every week on Bullseye, we close with a recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. You know, I hate to admit that I work in the fashion industry, even to myself. If you don't know, I own and edit a blog about menswear. And the bigger it's gotten, the closer I've gotten to the business side of fashion. And the closer I've gotten to the business of fashion, the less I've liked it. Whatever your stereotypes about the fashion industry are, they're mostly true. But there are exceptions, like Bill Cunningham. For decades, Cunningham has edited On the Street, the singularly democratic fashion spread in the New York Times. It features regular people alongside models and designers, and it comes to life in the audio slideshows Cunningham records for the Times website.
Hello, this is Bill Cunningham from the streets of New York City. And the fashion.
I knew that Cunningham was the rare fashion journalist who cared as much about 16-year-olds in Harlem as he did about models smoking outside of fashion shows. But I didn't know much else about him until I saw the wonderful documentary Bill Cunningham, New York. Cunningham's in his 80s, and he still bikes around the boroughs wearing a janitor's work coat and shooting on a camera so beat up you wonder how it even takes pictures. He goes to every European Fashion Week, sitting in the front row in his anti-fashion clothes, shooting madly and documenting the art that he loves.
Look at Veronica.
No, I haven't.
Hello, child. The diamonds have gotten bigger.
Right?
He was originally a milliner, making couture hats, but became a photographer by happenstance in the 60s and 70s. In the 80s, he refused payment for his work from the most prestigious fashion magazines in the world so he could have more editorial pages and full control of how what he shot was presented. If you don't take their money, he tells the filmmakers in Bill Cunningham, New York, they can't tell you what to do. His home is basically a hot plate, a piece of plywood with a mattress on it, and dozens of filing cabinets overflowing with photographs. The plywood mattress bed is suspended over a couple of the filing cabinets. He's basically a fashion monk.
Oh, boy, someday it's all going to fall down on me.
I know. I don't even want to think about that. My God. Bill,
if I disappear under a bunch of books, you'll know what. They're all fashion books. Imagine me having.
Cunningham is famously inscrutable. He refused to allow interviews of any kind for years. Even those closest to him know very little about him, and so it's shocking to hear the filmmakers ask him gently if he's gay.
So I'm going to ask you two very personal questions you may or may not want to answer. It's completely up to you. But have you ever had a romantic relationship in your entire life?
Now, do you want to know if I'm gay?
Yes.
Isn't that a riot? Well, that's probably why the family wanted to keep me out of the fashion world. If they wouldn't speak of such a thing. No, I haven't.
Never in your entire life?
No. It never occurred to me. I guess I just was interested in clothes. That's the obsession. It's probably a little peculiar.
He never quite answers the question, but he does allow that he's never had a true romantic relationship, which is heartbreaking. But Bill Cunningham's romance is with the clothes.
I'm not interested in the celebrities with their free dresses. It's the clothes, not the celebrity, and not the spectacle. It's as true today as it ever was. He who seeks beauty will find it.
That's my out shot.
I be a mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door.
That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our senior producer is Nick White. Our intern is Thomas Madison. Our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our theme music provided to us by The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label, Memphis Industries. You can find this show and all past Bullseye shows for free at MaximumFun.org. Max FunCon sold out, but be sure to go to BoatParty.biz if you'd like to join us for the Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival. It's happening in September. It's going to be very, very special. That's BoatParty.biz. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener-supported.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me. And I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.